You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that was Dave Rovics with a piece he wrote called Resistance, introducing the theme of today's presentation, Capitalism's Apocalypse, Why the Plutocrats Cannot Save Anyone, Not Even Themselves. This is with Dr. Michael Parenti, an internationally known award-winning author and lecturer and one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He's also the author of 20 books and some 300 articles published in scholarly journals, political periodicals, and various magazines and newspapers. For his central thesis of this presentation, Michael Parenti states that the goal of a good society is to structure social relations and institutions so that cooperative and generous impulses are rewarded, while antisocial ones are discouraged. The problem with capitalism is that it best rewards the worst part of us, ruthless, competitive, conniving, opportunistic, acquisitive drives, giving little reward and often much punishment, or at least much handicap, to honesty, compassion, fair play, many forms of hard work, love of justice, and a concern for those in need. This was recorded in Oakland, California, and thanks to Martin Spencer Davies, who recorded it.
Thank you so much. On a beautiful day like this, I would never come to hear me. So I really appreciate your doing that. The title, Capitalism's Apocalypse. But before we begin, I want to concentrate on that first word, capitalism, because there's an awful lot of misunderstanding. Whenever I've talked about capitalism, there'll always be somebody in the audience who would then raise their hand and they would say, but what about the entrepreneur who gets an idea and starts a new business and creates a few jobs? It's always said in this sentimental sing-song way, too. And does something for the community, and it contributes something. And I always say, I'm not talking about them. I'm not talking about mom-and-pop groceries and other places that perform sensible services and, you know, at a reasonable rate or something. We're not talking about that capitalism. We're talking about the mega-capitalism, the multinational, transnational, I try to use that word because multinational can mean multi-ethnic, some people. transnational multi. We're talking about Monsanto and Exxon and all these bruisers. 1,000 small businesses, in terms of political economic power, 1,000 small businesses have less power and significance than a few giant cartels. I mean, the small business today is like a squirrel dancing among the elephants. And squirrels that dance among elephants have a very low life expectancy. And you know, about 300-400 small businesses go out of business every week in America. Well, I think it's more than that, you know. And then others come in. Now, first off, I think we should notice that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy. It's an antagonistic relationship. Historically, capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They opposed, in this country, every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and for office holding. They oppose it with tooth and fang and claw and nail. They oppose the freedoms of an independent press and the strong dissident voices that emerge. They opposed mass demonstrations of dissent. They opposed the right to collective bargaining, the right to public education for all, which would be a basic condition for democracy, for citizenry. They opposed that. They fought against it for generations. They opposed the living wage and safe work conditions, which is a democratic condition. They opposed direct elections of office holders in many cases, even to today. Today, they oppose the direct election of the president. They're sticking with the Electoral College, which, of course, favors these small states, giving them a very loaded additional vote. And those small states usually go Republican, the red states, the ones you fly over when you go to New York. And they're called the flyover states, too. That's terrible. If this gets played in Akron or someplace, tell them I disapprove of the expression. Okay. They opposed more equitable and more democratic modes of representation. They opposed proportional representation. They've gotten a good deal of proportional representation undone in Italy, getting rid of then the whole multi-party social democracy, and so you've got these two left-of-center, right-of-center parties, and it begins to resemble the American alignment in terms of how politics go. They oppose easy access to the ballot. Today, as you see, conservatives, staunch warriors of capitalism, are passing laws in states like Missouri which require proof of birth. And there was that case of the one woman who was 86, who had been voting for, you know, for half a century or more, and who now suddenly had to write to Mississippi to get her birth certificate, and there was no record of it. So she's being disfranchised by these laws. It is their goal to disfranchise, to limit, to constrict, to undermine, to dilute democracy, while keeping certain democratic forms, because those forms legitimate the system and they convince people that they're free and they're self-selecting in their rulers. So we should keep in mind that capitalists, historically speaking, have had a near impossible time trying to act democratic. They often cannot even abide by their own constitution. I mean, it's their constitution. It's not all that democratic. It's full of all sorts of little rigs and snares and whatever else. So to defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, they must act unfairly, undemocratically, and unconstitutionally, using force and violence, deception and manipulation. You know, Eugene Victor Debs, the great American labor leader we know, socialist, he became aware of some of this when he was thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people. I mean, there he was, you know, if you've ever been roughed up and thrown in jail, you have time in jail, you could feel the bruise or the cup hit me here. Oh, it hit me here. Oh, and so you're sitting there and you're feeling your aches and knocks. I speak from experience on two occasions. And it really gets you thinking about the democracy that you live in. You know, you say, Jesus, what a democracy. God, thank God for American democracy. Jeez. And Debs, thrown in jail for struggling for the rights of working people, he came to the conclusion that the state was not a neutral arbiter. That's funny. Well, here's a dispute between two private interests, capital and labor, the owners of this factory and the people who work in the factory. There's two private interests. Why does the state come down so heavily on the side of one particular private interest? Why does it come down on the side of capital at such a cost to labor and with such brutality? So Debs came to the realization, as just a regular trade union leader who was trying to organize unions to get people a little more pay, better pay and all that, Debs come to the conclusion that capitalism was not just an economic system, but it was a whole social order that rigged the rules in its favor. And with that realization, of course, he was transforming himself from a labor leader to a socialist leader, while still being a labor leader. They're not mutually exclusive, of course. Now, while uneasy with democracy, while fearful of democracy, the capitalist class and their spokespersons and such make a big play about claiming democracy as their invention. They claim to be its progenitors, even as they subvert it, not only at home, but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist states have undermined, attacked, and destroyed political reform movements and revolutionary movements in countries throughout South America, Central America, Africa, the Middle East. And I'm talking about the Middle East, where we never think, oh, there's no democracy, and this phony president waged the war on Iraq to teach them democracy. Well, the Iraqis had a democratic revolution back in 1958, you know. It was a wonderful thing, broad-based coalition with all sorts of groups, and it was slowly undermined and destroyed through violence and assassination and everything else. The leader of the counter-revolutionary movement was a guy who was trained, equipped, advised, and backed by the CIA. His name was Saddam Hussein. You never hear about it. Whenever they talk about Saddam Hussein over the last 5 years, they always start like he was born in 2001 or something, you know. So they resist democratization not only at home but abroad. Well, the capitalist state has two core functions. The state that the capitalists have has two functions. The first is obviously to maintain and advance the interests of capital accumulation, to keep that whole process going. And that's the one we on the left usually focus on. There's another function which nobody seems to talk about much, and that is, in fact, it's so untalked about that it's slipped my mind now. No, I remember. I remember what it is. That's the function of protecting the capitalist system against the capitalists, saving capitalism from itself, because it is a self-devouring beast. It will eat everything in sight, and when there isn't anything else to eat, or sometimes There may be, but then there's this other juicy thing that it sees, it carries its own tail, and it starts to devour its own tail. I mean, the first one was to defend and advance the capital accumulation process. Profit, make sure profits are maintained, investments. That's why, you know, when things are in the pits and all that, some of these guys will get up and say, the economy's fine. Yeah, it's fine. They're making record profits. It's hard for them to see. What are you complaining about? I mean, it's working. The system is working. And the question is, I'll get to that later. We should look at that. Working for whom? Always ask that. There's a number of Latin American countries where you had near meltdowns. Brazil, remember that? I think Chile for a while. I mean, the most notably one in the late 90s was Argentina, where the whole thing went. That was a failure of the capitalist state to rein in the capitalists. They will go and they will plunder and they will pillage their own. If they can make a quick profit, if I could get the entire money stream that's going into this auto factory and walk away with $80 million, what the hell do I want the auto factory for? What do I care about that? I'm not interested in seeing that you get cars or refrigerators or food or clothing. I'm not in that business. I'm in the business of making a profit. That guy who was head of, I can't remember it now. This is called preparation, I forget. I remember he was in front of a Senate committee and he said, my corporation is not in the business of making cars. It's in the business of making a profit. And the largest possible profit, it wasn't Iococo, no. Largest possible profit. And that's marvelous. Every so often, truth breaks out in this whole thing. You know, a little glimmer, a shard of truth goes flying out into the murky darkness there. Argentina, it got so bad, you know what's happened since then. Workers started taking over these factories and businesses and refurbishing them and building them. Said, who needs the bosses? What did the boss ever do if we can just scrape together some capital in this net? I remember talking to my friend Horacio, who's an Argentinian. I said, and these bosses are coming back. They said, no, they're finished. They're out. Not true. They're coming back. Right now they're coming back claiming their property rights. Sure, they got a profitable business all again. They want to take it all over again and milk it and plunder it for all it's worth. We saw the same thing happening in the U.S. Charles Keating, he built Lincoln Savings and Loans. He built it of $200 million. You see, that's what it's about. Why bother making refrigerators? You got to get the costs, materials, deal with labor. Then you got to sell them, hope to make it back, realize your investment, isn't that? When you can just go and steal the money that's in there. Just steal the money. He did. What did he get? 4 years in prison, Charles Keating did, for $200 million. I know a lot of people, don't raise your hand, who would do four years if they can walk out then with $200 million. I think he had to give back 30 million. They never seem to have, I don't know where I put it all. I mean, here, I'll give you back something. John Regas, Adelphia. Ken Lay, Enron. And then all these other ones, WorldCom, you can name them all. Enron was a prosperous, very profitable corporation until Lay and his buddy Fastrow plundered it. They just milked it out, and 5,000 employees are out of a job and out of all their savings that they put into this floated up, bloated paper stock, and Lay walked away with all that money. I mean, that's the magnificent thievery. But the point is, if everybody's behaving that way, the system as a system begins to collapse. So I, as the capitalist government, have to persuade you to not do that, you see. But if you've been doing that, you might even go to jail, unless you're Vice President of the United States and President of the United States. Then that insider trading stuff, of course, things happen. I don't know. I didn't know that. I sold it just 2 weeks before it collapsed, but that's because I was advised to. I don't know anything about that. And I do think probably that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Democrats recognize this this second function. At least more Democrats recognize it. I don't know if they even give it that explicit a view, but they have a little bit more of a sense of trying to hold hold off the beast from devouring itself. Well, and why go way, way back to Ken Lay, which is like, what, 4 years ago? We can look right today that the thing, we may be facing a meltdown, the subprime hustling, the international bank run on the dollar. I mean, there is now an enormous debt, and you can't live on debt. Eventually, the whole system can collapse. Oh, What a Wonderful Life. Think of Jimmy Stewart in the bank, you know. Instead of a little town, think of the whole world doing that. I mean, Japan has something like $490 billion. They don't want any more dollars. The Chinese don't want to have about the same amount. Not quite as much as Japan, but they don't want to. Close to half a trillion American dollars. They don't even want them. They want euros. They'll even take pounds. They'll even take their own currency. They sit back up. And besides that trade debt, we have a national debt. The national debt is the money that the government owes to citizenry, both Americans and foreigners, and that has grown. When George W. Bush took power, the national debt was $5 trillion. It's now, as of this January, it will be $10 trillion. He managed to double it. The conservatives have discovered that the national debt is a very wonderful way of dampening spending on human services. It's also a marvelous way of undermining the federal government's ability to perform any functions for us. And it's also a means of privatizing the federal budget. The greater chunk of this budget that goes to just servicing this debt, the less money you have for anything else. So what you're doing is every tax dollar you pay in, a larger and larger portion of it is simply being cut off and then put into the pockets of rich private creditors. So the government has for years now been borrowing money from the people they should be taxing, meanwhile cutting the taxes of those very same people so that they'll have even more money to borrow to the government. And all of this we pay for. We pay for that. That's the way the system goes. Now, giant corporate capitalism is, by its innate nature, its essence, an apocalyptic system. It is, when left purely to its own devices. The essence of capitalism is the transformation of living nature into commodities, and commodities into dead capital. Into just so many numbers in the book. I mean, where is Bill Gates's $50 billion? Where is it? Does he keep it in his mattress? It's a lot of numbers. It's numbers and stocks and numbers and bonds and numbers and funds of various kinds. And a lot of it may be in investments of other businesses and things like that. So capitalism, while it's doing that, while it's transforming living nature into dead capital, is also foisting its diseconomies and toxicities upon the general public and the natural environment. I remember years ago in 1971, when I was teaching at the University of Vermont, I announced that the environmental movement is potentially subversive of capitalism. And I remember a couple of colleagues saying, "You're getting carried away, and don't, where are you going with that?" and blah, 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 that sort of thing. But I think it's true. And, you know, by the way, it's not true that the corporate class has ignored the environmental problem. Quite the contrary. They have vehemently and strenuously attacked it. They've attacked the environmental movement, calling them tree huggers and eco-Gestapo and this and that and all sorts of names like that. And have remained studiously hostile to it. Capitalism is a force not of Eros, but of Thanatos. Is that how you pronounce it? In German it would be Thanatos, but in English we say Thanatos, right? Now, you know, from Greek mythology, the two forces in life is the force of life and love, that's Eros, and then there's the force of death, and that's Thanatos. And I think Freud and others have reduced those to personal individual drives or instincts. You know, we have a life instinct, but we have he's got a death instinct. You hear things like that when people pretend to, as if we really know what motivates other people at the psychological level. In most cases, we don't. But Debs, getting back to Debs sitting in his cell, Eugene Victor Debs is sitting there, and he remarks that the extent to which life in an advanced industrial capitalist state, the extent to which it was bearable or decent or survivable, depended on the humanizing effects of democratic struggle. He was saying, I now see that the extent to which we could even bear this thing and even help it, and inadvertently helping it to survive, is by trying to ameliorate its worst abuses and make certain changes so that we can breathe and live and find a little space where we can be human, you see. So we create little patches of community while this colossus keeps going on us. So that democratic struggle is part of the class struggle. And that's what those struggles are about. That's what Debs was doing. He was doing class struggle. He was doing democratic struggle. He ended up, when he got out of jail, getting thrown back into jail by that great believer of democracy, Woodrow Wilson, for opposing World War I and saying this is a war that the working people of Europe and of America have no interest in. It's not something we should be fighting and all that sort of thing. He went back to jail for that one. I believe that's true. Certainly a lot of other people did on the left. So that class struggle and democratic struggle imposes restrictions. It forces some reforms and has restraints. But that's about it. I only got a couple of more points. Have I been going too long? Okay. Well, is capitalism a successful system? I mean, they've been crowing, you know, ever since 1991, too, with the overthrow of the Soviet Union. They've been crowing about capitalism is the successful system, is the system that delivers the goods. It's brought us all this good life. Is it a successful system? I would argue yes and no, depending upon where, what is your position in the social order. You tend to see social reality according to the position you occupy in the social structure. And not only tend to see, it's not just a perceptual thing, it's also a actual material reality. Let's start with the capitalist leaders. Those who are both state leaders, those who are rich, among the richest up there in that top fraction of 1%. It's not the top 1% or 2%. It's about 0.04 of 1% really, really owns the lion's share, most of what's going on. And they're the ones who make this enormous wealth. So, and next time anybody gives you the quintile thing, tell them to shut up. I mean, the top 20% now used to make 8 times more than the bottom 20%, but now it's 14 times more than the bottom 1%. What's that got to do with it? You know what it takes to be in the top 20%, the top quintile? If you make over $70,000, you're in the top 5% in America. You're making more than 80% of other people in the country. If you make $100,000, you're in the top 3%. You make $300,000, like you're up in the top 1%. So it's this fraction way, way up. That's when the curve, the earning curve, really gets very steep, as those little tenths of fractions of that last half of 1%. And that's where the wealth really goes. And in fact, they keep pulling ahead of the people who are in the top 2 or 3%, so forth.
You're listening to Dr. Michael Parente, Capitalism's Apocalypse, on Raising Sand Radio, KZSU Stanford. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore.
All right, George W. Bush is one of those people. And in August of 2008, which is still this month, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, came out with a statement. It's about time she actually said something confrontational and partisan. She said, George Bush is a failure in all of his policies. He's just a failure. I disagree. I think George Bush is a smashing success in almost every area. This massive debt that he's built up, you know, this massive increase in military budget, his ventures abroad, war has been very good to George Bush, at least for a while it was. Now, that did backfire a little in terms of the polls and all that. The massive shift in the tax burden, that's massively been shifted from that top group. The undoing of the real estate tax, which they called the death tax, which, by the way, the tax did not apply to anybody who made $2 million or less, who had $2 million in wealth or less. And the tax was very progressive. It really got heavy for the very, very rich. I mean, how many people actually leave $2 million net? I don't mean your house may be worth this and you still got this mortgage and all that sort of thing. But how many people actually, not that many. So Bush is a smashing success there. Cutbacks and defunding of human services, including public education, environmental protections. He's been successful in all of that. He's not a total success. There's a couple of places he hasn't gotten through yet. Medicare and Social Security. But what they do with these things is, instead of direct confrontations, and that's Gingrich taught him that, and Gingrich called the Republican Revolution, and he started wiping out the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, is that the reaction from his own Republicans out in the Midwest say, what the hell are you doing? They like the clean air and clean water. And his revolution blew up in smoke. But what they do now is they dilute, they just detract, they just defund a little bit, they just cut back on these parasitic groups like disabled children feeding off the federal budget. We start giving this money to disabled children. Where are we going to get the money for bailouts for Fannie Mae and Freddie Muck and the like? Okay. So try, if you want to have a radical analysis and not just a liberal complaint, try to look at success the way the big money boys do. Capitalism is less than fully successful in countries like Norway, Finland, Denmark. Countries that you say, well, wait, they're very prosperous and all that. But capitalism is not interested in prosperity. It's interested in profits. Please don't confuse those two things. By the way, all the social democracy gains that are made in the social democracies like Norway, Finland, Netherlands, Belgium, France to a lesser extent, Italy to a lesser extent, Germany, what?
Denmark,
very good, a very good one, yeah. even those gains are not that secure. They got to fight to keep this. There are rollback efforts going on rather successfully now in Italy, for instance. So they're never secure. There's always the problem of a lower rate, What the capitalists hate about Scandinavia and these what we would consider prosperous social democracies, from our point of view as citizens and consumers and workers, what they dislike about it is that they have a lower rate of return on your investment. When you invest a dollar in Sweden, given all the regulations and restrictions and protections and this and that and high wage levels and all that, you may make back, you may realize the value of it, or maybe $2 or $3 for every dollar you invest. You invest that dollar in Indonesia, now there's a capitalist success story. And your return is more like $11 or $12 per dollar, you see. It's the difference between having to pay a worker $15 an hour, plus benefits, plus paid leave, plus this and that, plus environmental costs and protections and all that. And in another country, none of those. You don't have to pay any of those things, and you pay the worker 18 cents an hour. 18 cents instead of $18. Okay, so that's where success lies. Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia. Andrei Vlitic, an interesting guy, almost unknown by most people. He writes about Micronesia. He asked me to be part of the blog or website writing about things. I think I sent him one article that, if you really stretch it, well, it was relevant to Micronesia, but I can't do anything in Micronesia. But Andrei Vlitic is he's an Eastern European who is an expert on Micronesia. He writes some very interesting things about Bali and East Timor and Australia and things like that. He just recently did an article on Indonesia. He said, here it is. Here it is, the capitalist paradise. This is really it. This is the model they're going for. This is what they want the entire world to be. He said, well, let's see. Let's look at the things they do the best. They produce commodities. He said, in the last few months, I bought 2 DVD players, both of which broke. Couldn't get anything. The warranty wasn't respected or given any regard. There's no customer service in most of these companies. We tried to hire or rent something, and something else happened. The wrong thing came, and he keeps talking about these utter nightmare things that, while they may happen to us once in a while, were happening to him all the time. He said, Indonesia is a totally dysfunctional society. The water, he said, the water has been privatized. And most of the water that people drink is terrible in its quality. He said, the air is terrible. He said, they have abolished all public health services, pretty much. And he said, all that happens is that Indonesians don't live as long as people in other places. They have a low rate. The rich in Indonesia, the rich live very well. They have sumptuous places. They have the best of everything, most of it flown in and imported. They have regiments of servants and workers and assistants who they pay practically nothing, some of whom are working for a bowl of gruel a day or whatever, or, as I said, 18 or 14 cents an hour. I think it's down to 12 cents an hour. They want to really do nothing. He says, rampant crime, terrible poverty, chaotic auto traffic, no environmental protections. That's terrible. So that's the model. That is the success. That's the success they're looking for. Remember that. So capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but also to prosperity. But that's not true, as I've just been saying. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. To the extent that there is prosperity, it's because of, as Debs thought of it in prison, it's because of our struggle to create a minimum wage law, child labor law, Social Security, better wages and such, and there we are. But their goal is the opposite. It's really to create poverty, because the poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less. I mean, why is it you won't work for 18 cents an hour or 14 cents an hour the way the Indonesians do? Is it because we Americans are just so much more self-respecting? We wouldn't consider it? No, it's because we're at a stage of historical struggle where we don't have to. But that goal is to get us back to 1900, because in 1900 we did work for pennies an hour. The U.S., half a century before the term was invented, the U.S. was a third world country. It had widespread underemployment. It had tuberculosis epidemics in some of the major cities and typhoid epidemics and the like. It had all sorts of desperation, no public health, no public education, well, limited public education in some areas, only up to grade school and such. And that's what they're trying to get back to. Now, let me just say that the reactionaries in the Republican Party have enjoyed over the last 30 years a remarkable success. Back in 1978, and I got the quote in an essay I wrote, which appeared in one of my books. The book is out of print now, Land of Idols. But it was a group of plutocrats meeting and coming out and saying, this has got to stop. I mean, giving word to Jimmy Carter, who was president at the time, this has got to stop. I mean, where's it going to end? You guys got this gain, this, that, the other thing. We're going to end up being a social democracy. I found it fascinating that he used the term. Fast forward 30 years. There was an article recently, and of course, this morning I started looking for it in the piles of paper, and I couldn't find it. It'll resurface again. It does about every 3-4 months or something like that. An article I clipped from the New Yorker dealing with the question that the GOP is having problems, which is they're getting a shortage of issues. They don't quite know where to attack anymore. And as one of them said, you know, we've achieved our goal, which was to prevent the United States from becoming a social democracy. He used the term again. These guys know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. This is not an analysis I'm superimposing on it. It's what they themselves think about and work on. And they have perfectly scripted and ideologized their approaches to things. Just take that Saddleback, was it a debate? What would you call it? Where Obama and McCain were there, event, and the questions that were being asked. At one point, the evangelical minister says, Senator Obama, if you were president, he didn't say if you were president, he said, who on the Supreme Court would you wish was not on the Supreme Court? And there was some little laugh, and Obama goes, I don't want to be rude and all that. I think I would not want to see Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court because he is not qualified. He's really not very qualified. That's a bullshit answer. Ooh, cut that. Let's do it again. That's a terrible answer. Take 2, 4, 3, 1. That's a ridiculous answer. It's not that Thomas isn't qualified. It's that he's a reactionary. He's the worst reactionary on the court. He's even worse than Scalia on a few of the criminal law decisions, you know. And that's what you should say, but he doesn't want to be partisan. He's saying, I wouldn't want him on the court because he's really not qualified, you know. Justice Scalia, who I do think is brilliant and all that, and kissing up the right. The liberals are never happier than when they're sucking up to the right and left. Oh, we don't have any disagreement. Oh, we really agree on certain things. Oh, we this, that. Oh, really, we'll reach across the aisle to you and all that. You don't hear the right wingers doing that at all. They kind of just look. He says, Scalia, who I think is brilliant, I would rather not have him on the court. Think he's been, you know, I forget, he used some word like, not bullying, but something like that, he pushes this or that. This is a man of moderation. And then the evangelical guy said, "What about Chief Justice Roberts?" He said, I've met Justice Chief Justice Roberts and talked with him and all that. He's an intelligent guy." And blah blah, fuzz, wiggle. Right. Then the minister said, "Senator McCain, who would you like to see, if anybody, removed from the Supreme Court?" He said, "I want to see Justice Beyer, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Souter, and Justice Stevens removed from the Supreme Court because I believe," and he gave the perfect scripted narrative about liberal judicial activism, "that I want people on the Supreme Court who adhere to the Constitution, who are faithful to it, and do not inject their personal sentiments into the decisions." These people have been saying that for since Reagan at least, for 25 years, they've been saying that, and they can say it now through the process of repetition. It becomes part of the background opinions and such, and they can say that. And he just had the answer, and he does this again and again. And I said this like months ago. I said, "Obama is going to get his ass kicked. He doesn't even know what it's about, nor do those bright little super bright advisors of his know their ass from their elbow." The same people who advised Dukakis and advised John Kerry don't get it. They don't get what it's about. But McCain, who has been in the Senate for many years now, he knows this stuff perfectly well. All the right-wing reactionaries are coming around to him saying, "Hey, he's pretty good. He's learning how to debate like a Republican now." So that's what we got to understand, the importance of ideology. And the fact is that their goal is to get us to Indonesia. Our goal at this historical stage, at least, is to get us to Denmark and then beyond. At least. The Republicans 30 years ago understood that they are going to have to change the whole universe of discourse. Back in the 40s, to be a liberal was quite okay. Tom Dewey, who was governor of New York and became the Republican candidate for president, he made a statement. He said, "Well, they want party realignment." And by the way, that was always a favorite political science line. We need party realignment. Because the parties were rather distorted. You had, in Vermont, you had Republicans like Senator Prouty who were populists and progressives. And in Mississippi, you had some Democrats sometimes who were reactionaries or whatever, and you had all sorts of peoples mixed up and splits and all that. And Dewey said, "Yeah, if we put all the liberals in one party and all the conservatives in another party, then the liberals would win all the elections." Well, you know, it's happened. It really has happened now. There are very few anybody could be called a liberal in the Republican Party. It's the alignment. The alignment is very conservative. But they're winning elections. It's a different universe of discourse today where people are even afraid to even call themselves a liberal. They've been pulverized and battered. And all the time they've been battered, they haven't hit back. They haven't made an analysis. They haven't. Of course, and I don't forget, the right wing also controls the media, pretty much the media. The media, no matter how liberal that media is, will never go cross that last line. They will never say that capitalism is working well in Indonesia. They will never say that. They'll say, "Well, it's a mess, isn't it?" Or they will never say that George Bush has had a successful administration. If it's Bill Moyers or whatever the guys are, they'll all tell you what a terrible mess it is, and isn't it time we get rid of him, and that's that. You have to get a class analysis. You have to persistently look at these issues as being connected to larger sets of social relations, and not just that Bush is stupid and he did this. How stupid he is. He's not stupid. You're stupid when you think this guy who's sticking it to you up one side, down the other is stupid. You got a problem, okay? But that's why I brought you all here today, to solve this problem. And usually I say, "Now let's just keep this among ourselves in this room." But this, you gotta go forth now, yay, and speak the truth. Thank you very much for coming.
That was Dr. Michael Parente with Capitalism's Apocalypse. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. And as always, if you want to listen to any of our archive shows, visit our website at www.raisingsandradio.org. We have other interviews with Dr. Michael Parente, as well as a lot of other political and cultural analysts, creative folks, poetry, movies. Take a listen. Go to the website, www.raisingsandradio.org. You can also visit our blog at http://raisingsandradio.blogspot.com, where you can comment on our shows. As always, you're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio and make comments on the show you heard today or suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future. Let's go out again with Dave Rovics, and this piece is called The Minimum Wage Strike.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet. Things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one flipping burgers. All the grills were cold. Onion rings were in their bags. Fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the truck. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. The workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tykes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Parents were housebound, their nannies left the job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed. The footlocker was locked up, boss had to take a hike, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet. Things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
Expressed on Raising Sand are that of the hosts and guests, not of KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford.